hour number one of the Dr. Future show coming up next. Hour number one, Dr. Future, straight ahead.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get an answer?
Okay, we are back in the studios in Santa Cruz.
Woohoo! Local. Love you, California. Love you, Santa Cruz. Love you, Bay Area. It's really wonderful to be home. Yeah. Of course, it was pretty wonderful to be on vacation, too. But
it's a nice planet. I think we'll keep it.
Absolutely. We had some really awesome experiences. Kind of like, it felt like we were in Camelot because the same day we would have a beautiful blue sky, clouds, rain, thunderstorms, starry nights, Perseids, meteor showers. It was jam-packed.
That's true. A lot of cool stuff in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we did have bandwidth in the middle of nowhere. Actually, we have more bandwidth there than we're having here right now.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough.
That's true. We're going to have to wing it from our memories of the various links that we have. But hey, yeah. Folks, you may not have the same bandwidth limitations that we do temporarily. So you can go to the drfutureshow.com links page and you can see the slate of fantastic, unbelievable facts that Dr. Future has pulled together for us to consider today.
Yes, you will be actually in the future because it'll be before we even talk about it.
That's right. That's right. And just like the starlight that is coming to us from light years away and millions of years in the past, these links have already been placed on the digital interface for you to see.
Yes, yes. So let's go with the links that I left open on my page here, huh?
All right. Talk about synchronicity steering wheels here, huh?
I know, right? But let's do some of the news. Like, well, some of the news that just came in was how Blue Origin is going to be making an announcement next month.
Okay, you got to tell me. Blue Origin, this is a little bit new to my awareness. Blue okay. Origin is what, who, where, why?
It's one of the companies involved with the commercial launch of space tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy behind it is somebody that's been in the news lately, the billionaire behind Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos.
He has his own space program called Blue Origin.
Mm-hmm.
The media has been invited by him for an announcement that will be at the Cape Canaveral location next month. I believe it's on the 15th of September or so. Something to look forward to from his world. It's been known that the company has intended to work on building rockets at the space coast and will be launching them by using the Air Force Station there. And that there have been talks between the company representatives and other agencies involving the construction of a new facility called Exploration Park. And it will be used as some kind of manufacturing unit, which will also be hosting space flights, which will be taking place from what they call Launch Complex 36.
Hmm.
Launch Complex 36.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They had sought out approval from the State Economic Development in Space Florida, and they're trying to finalize an agreement with Blue Origin before a big announcement next month.
September 15th.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So Blue Origin, now this is actually, okay, Jeff Bezos, Amazon. Last year, Amazon did that big 60 Minutes scoop and announced that they were going to get into drone deliveries, right?
Yeah, they were in for that. Also, Jeff was on in the news last week for being less than one of the most favorite companies to work for.
Oh, that's right. He really got blasted last week for being a little too robotized in the point system.
Yeah, like, it's like he's part
unhappy employees crying at their desks because they're just not working hard enough to keep the machines happy.
Yeah, he's like part machine or something. You know? It's like he's not making the humans as happy as they'd like to be.
And yet, in his defense, he wrote a very conciliatory letter to people saying, look, this is not the Amazon that I'm aware of, and of course, we'll look into it. So,
yeah.
Yeah, nothing like a feedback loop, right?
Exactly.
So Blue Origin, though, I really like that name because, okay, the idea that he wants to get into novel kinds of delivery, Blue Origin may be Blue Marble Origin, and he's going to, like, actually send Amazon products to space.
Yeah, you think so? For the new solar system economy?
I think so. I mean, why else is this a Cape Canaveral announcement,
you need
right?
Delivery to the ISS. We'll get it from Amazon via
maybe.
Blue Origin.
Yeah, Blue Origin coming from the Blue
for
Marble.
For space FedEx.
Yeah, for space FedEx, exactly. For space Amazon.
Well, in the real world of space exploration, till date, to the current date, Blue Origin has completed a test flight, which was an unmanned of its New Shepard suborbital vehicle.
Suborbital vehicle.
Yeah, and
that's what I was thinking, because we saw that photograph. There was some report we scanned about global warming creating a new visible layer of the atmosphere that was blue, and it was something like 50 miles up.
New types of clouds.
Types of clouds in the blue layer, the upper layer of the atmosphere.
Right. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with that, as far as I know.
Oh, well, just blue.
Yeah, blue.
It's another Blue Origin story.
Right.
Well, synchronicity steering wheel.
Okay, Mrs. Future. Yes, blue clouds, Blue Origin. Okay. Well, in this case, the New Shepard suborbital vehicle took place from the West Texas launch site, which is owned by the company. And they plan to launch manned flights of orbital rockets. And the time span that they've set is about 5 years out.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that 2020 seems to be where the whole space community thinks that our programs are all going to be viable.
Yeah.
They're going to be out there.
Yeah. These guys are pretty serious about it. So it'll be very interesting to see what that really official announcement is as it comes in next month. And we'll keep you posted on that one.
Right.
Elon Musk's Hyperloop has hit the news. It sounds like science fiction. It's kind of a high-speed rail line that would fling us across the country in hours using essentially pneumatic tubes. You heard
pneumatic
about that?
Vacuum tubes. I want to ride.
Back to the 50s.
I want to ride in a pneumatic vacuum tube.
Well, the big news there is that Hyperloop Transportation Technologies has announced that they have signed agreements to work with Oerlikon Leibold Vacuum and global engineering design firm, AECOM, AECOM. Mm-hmm. The two companies will be lending their expertise in exchange for stock options in the company.
Great. Oh, boy. Sweat equity in your second job. Now, this is really a brand new approach to an entrepreneurial solution. Listen, let's talk about this a little more when we come back from the break, okay? You're listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSCO. We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yeah, we were just mentioning the Hyperloop project, the Elon Musk Hyperloop transportation project, essentially sending us around in pneumatic tubes.
Okay, so they're actually doing little funding. They've got a company that's partnering with them that specializes in engineering vacuum parts, right?
Oerlikon, Oerlikon, Leibold, vacuum and global engineering design firm AECOM, AECOM. Now, what's interesting is that they also have support from engineers from Boeing and SpaceX that are already lending their time to the effort.
Mm-hmm.
So they see this as a validation that their model works. They're building a prototype track to test it out on.
Yeah, this is really funny. The picture looks like a sci-fi train track. If I was a little kid and wanted to create a train track, this one would be the coolest one I could imagine.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
That'd be cool because you'll have these extremely low air pressure inside tubes and with capsules in them filled with people that would zip around them at near supersonic speeds.
Hmm.
So you wonder what happened if one of those capsules went supersonic. I wonder how that would affect the system.
Yeah.
I mean, idle speculation. Anyway, Musk is publishing the paper, encouraging anyone interested to check it out.
Uh-huh. Well, didn't he publish the Hyperloop idea like a year ago?
He said, white paper.
Folks, I'm too busy. Please run with this idea. Let's have some Hyperloop.
Yeah, and people are starting to run with
here.
It. And that's what this is all about.
Uh-huh. Also, this was a joint venture, or is it a Kickstarter?
Let's see. It was created by Jumpstart Fund.
So it is a crowdsource.
I'm sorry, which created Hyperloop Transportation, which brought together engineers willing to spend their free time working on the design in exchange for stock options.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. That's not exactly the kind of crowdsourcing we're used to, where the funding comes in as a donation, but actually this is like the work comes in as a donation of time, and the perk is stock options in the company.
Yeah, you believe in it, it's going to happen.
Right. But it's not people's day job.
No. Yeah. The prototype will run 5 miles through what's known as Quay Valley, Quay, which is a planned community rising out of nothing, essentially, along Interstate 5, halfway between San Francisco and L.A.
Ooh, let's go cruise it. Let's go find it.
Next time we go to L.A., we'll stop off.
Sounds good.
The startup claims they have up to about 400 team members already working on the project. They're not employees, but they're people with regular day-to-day jobs. And they're spending their time for these stock options. It's easy to see why people would want to get involved. It's a chance to work on something really revolutionary, a new form of transportation, even if some people remain convinced that this will never happen, like flying cars. We're not going to have pneumatic tube people, transporters. Forget it.
Well, I don't know. But I think it could
be,
happen.
Right? There's 400 people that are putting in part-time into this sort of thing.
I mean, part of the technology is that they've got like magnetic lev tracks, right? So the tubes just are
They're tubes, right? There's no maglev.
But there is some kind of a track that they're on.
Tubes.
Yeah, they're tubes. But they're not. It's not. I don't think it's just tubes. I think it's tubes and maglev together.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't read that part.
Yeah.
Traveling in a vacuum tube is what I noticed.
Right.
On this thing. And, you know, with the future of transportation, you're also evolving towards autonomous vehicles and flying capsules through vacuum tubes. Kind of makes sense, you know, that we'd have that as another option.
Yeah. It really boggles the imagination. You get on something that's similar to a spaceship, or maybe like that car in Tomorrowland, right? The one that in the dream when all of those space astronauts like sit down on the on the car. That to me could be a vacuum tube vehicle, right?
As opposed to a monorail.
Yes.
Or something that Disney would be familiar with.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so that's getting a little more serious. 400 part-time people trading stock options for building the Hyperloop.
Hey, with some real estate off of Highway 5. That's pretty serious.
That and the Blue Origin, getting interesting.
Okay.
Okay, and
People do want to get they want to get off the planet, and they want to get around the planet faster. Some things never change, right? Transportation makes us think we can go faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, and
sound.
In terms of speed of light communication, there has been some news this week about the $100 million search for intelligent alien life that billionaire investor Yuri Milner committed to.
Oh, yeah. He's the Russian fellow who... Okay, so he's given $100 million to...
The most powerful search for intelligent life in the universe to date.
SETI?
$100 million. Well, SETI is one of the... It's called Project Breakthrough Listen.
Breakthrough Listen.
Yes, and it's very rare that the SETI world, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence world, gets $100 million. It's mostly dedicated people that have been eking out spare time on telescopes and radio receivers and to be able to do this. But now they actually have some decent funding for doing a real search for this.
You no longer have to be a mad scientist. You can actually make a living looking for extraterrestrial life.
A few people can, anyway. NASA had once had its own $10 million a year SETI program, but Congress defunded it back in 93. And hasn't been revived since.
Mm.
So today, SETI work is mostly done by indie places like the SETI Institute over in the Valley in Mountain View, and Berkeley, at Harvard, and it's privately funded.
That's interesting. Back to 93, I think in 93, we were probably, at some point in the mid-90s, we were involved with the SETI at Home project, where we were actually using screensavers to help do some of the SETI
the processing of some of the signal information
the
that they got. Right, yeah,
right.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes, NASA does invest millions of dollars in its search for life beyond Earth, but mostly it's been looking for the microbial life, like the robotic Mars missions, the Curiosity rover and such, have searched for liquid water and organic materials, you know, ingredients for life as we know it.
I guess the serious scientists at NASA believe that we're more likely to find microbes than radio transmissions.
Well, certainly on Mars. You know, we don't see any big life forms on Mars or the moons of Jupiter or anything like that. So they're looking for microbial life in our own solar system, which they might find. Mm-hmm. It'd be very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's life in the most basic sense is what NASA has been focused on, which is the most pragmatic. Mm-hmm. Microbial life searching has been a high priority for Congress and NASA. But Milner's $100 million investment looking for intelligent life is a whole nother story. Like, how do you search for intelligent life? It's really different from looking for microbial life. Microbial life, you might look for methane traces or gases, farts, basically. You know, things that biological life in its most simpler form would create. Uh-huh. But how do you look for intelligent life? It's a whole other story.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. We evolved 200,000 years ago, and we've only been sending out what we might consider intelligent signals into the universe for less than a century at this point. Many believe that our first signal into the cosmos was Hitler's speech at the opening of the 1936 Olympic Games.
Believing that radio transmission is the thing that's going to allow other...
Yeah, the first part of the...
intelligent civilizations to find us, huh?
Yes, before we started developing
the
laser-based
stuff. So it could be the Dr. Future show is, like, looking for signs of intelligent life.
Well, we are going out there into the ionosphere and beyond ourselves, being on an AM transmitter here.
That's right. Same as... I wonder how it compares to that first one you were talking about.
Hitler's broadcast? Well, that was high enough frequency to penetrate the ionosphere and go out into space. And then it moves through the universe at the speed of light, decreasing in intensity as it goes further away. So that was the first sign of intelligence from this planet that went out into the universe, was our electromagnetic radio waves, and then television not that long after that.
I think that's what the debate is. Is it really the right way to look for signs of intelligent life?
Well, they've
are
evolved
radio waves the best way?
Well, they have evolved way beyond radio waves now.
Yeah, SETI, I think that's why the funding is so debatable, because people are not convinced that looking for radio waves is really the right approach.
Yeah, no, they've gone way, way beyond that. The first modern SETI experiment was back in 1960 by Frank Drake here at UC Santa Cruz, who was on the East Coast then. It was called Project OSMA, and that was looking for frequencies that which maybe intelligence may come through big giant radio telescope dishes. Now we're able to not just listen to a few frequencies, we can listen to tens of millions of frequencies simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And we can cover 10 times more of the sky than we did in the previous SETI experts, 5 times more of the radio spectrum, 100 times faster than any other previous efforts.
Wow. We're late for a break.
Uh-oh, better go.
You gotta go. Okay, folks, stay tuned. CBS News coming right up.
This one, then? Hey, okay, we're back again on the air. We're just talking to Richard here about getting some more machines on the
Wi-Fi. We keep bringing in more and more machines, and they all need their own on-ramp to the internet. It's like Cape Canaveral right here at KSCO radio station, getting the screens to talk to the net for the radio.
Yeah.
It is. It's like NASA control, big time.
So we're in the middle of this piece on the new $100 million funding of SETI. This is kind of interesting. Seth Shustak, you might have heard of him. He's over at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, senior astronomer, director of SETI for research. He attributes an increased breadth of search for the ongoing search for extraterrestrial intelligence to digital technology. He says we're able to look at more of the radio dial at a single gulp, where literally you're looking at tens of millions of channels at once. Thanks to the improvements of digital electronics, it will give even more than that. It will be hundreds of millions of channels at once, and maybe even a billion channels at once.
We used to point our little SETI ray gun just at like one little star or one little galaxy, right? Now we're pointing a giant spectrum of ray guns out to 100 million galaxies.
How do you analyze a billion channels at once? Well, that's where they're looking towards all of us, folks. Yes, that's right, crowdsourcing. The Breakthrough Listen project that they're putting together will involve 9 million volunteers. who will offer their spare computer time for data crunching.
This could be you.
Yes, yeah, you could be part of it. Remember the SETI at Home project back in the mid-90s?
Yeah, we were just talking about that. Yeah, we were devotees to that little experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So keep in mind, our solar system is over 4.5 billion years old. We've only been listening for intelligence signals from the universe for 50 years. And many civilizations, tech civilizations out there could have died out, or we might have missed them or not even listened in the right place yet because the distance from us to their signals haven't had time to reach us, all kinds of stuff like that. So Neil deGrasse Tyson addressed this in his book, Space Chronicles. He said, if aliens are out there and they can detect our signals, why haven't they reached out to us? He says, for all we know, the aliens may have tried to get in touch centuries ago and have concluded that there's no intelligent life on Earth.
Yeah, that's probably what happened. And
centuries ago, there would be no signals from us, right? So they'd be looking elsewhere by now.
That's right. Centuries ago, all they could detect was our methane.
Yeah, right. There are microbes on Earth. He also points out that a more humbling possibility is that the aliens did become aware of us and decided not to pay attention. That maybe we weren't worth their attention.
Well, they were looking for signs of intelligent life, and we didn't make the cut.
They put a sign up on our planet saying, caution, children at play.
Right.
Leave them alone.
Adult supervision required.
They're still trying to figure out how to get along with each other.
That's right.
But not everyone likes the idea of sending out a signal. Like, there's listening, and then there's sending out a signal that, like, maybe we are here. Hey, we're here. Pay attention to that. Stephen Hawking pointed out that aliens, if they came to visit us, the outcome might be much like when Columbus landed in America. It didn't turn out too well for the locals.
There you go. Oh, boy. Well, we can actually talk about that a little bit later today when our guest for the second hour comes on.
Yes, yes. Bruce Damer. Dr. Bruce Damer, yes.
Dr. Bruce, and when we first met Dr. Bruce like 20-some-odd years ago, he was hosting these amazing seminars called Contact Consortiums, and he was bringing together all of the great thinkers who were interested in imagining first contact and what the initiation of relationships with the extraterrestrials would be like. Right. Mm-hmm. So you had people like Jim Dilatosa coming and talking about simulating how to not make a faux pas when you meet an alien life form.
Yes. Once you establish contact, you could easily create confusion or misinterpretation of contact.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be very bad for us.
You might think burping is polite.
Yes. Yeah. The bottom line is $100 million private money is going into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Mostly search, not sending out a signal, but a search.
Right. Project Listen.
Yeah, Breakthrough Listen project.
Breakthrough Listen. And the next one is Breakthrough Speak or something, right?
It might be harder to finance that. They did have one. The Arecibo message back in 73 was really interesting because it was a message that said that we were from the third planet of this solar system, and it showed an outline of our body and indicated a few things about what we understood about the universe. And the only response we've had from that so far has been like in 04, I think it was, 03, was a crop circle.
The Crabtree alien.
Well, that too, that came
later.
Oh,
that wasn't a response?
No. Well, that was the Crabtree, that was the 04. Uh-huh. But 03, there was a direct response in the same field as the Crabtree alien a year earlier that replicated the message that we sent out. It has a little image of a human being on it, but it had a little alien head instead of a human being, you know, in the same thing. So that's the only response we've gotten so far. And, you know, the origins of crop circles are...
So in 2004, yeah. So it's like the 30-year anniversary, we got some kind of cryptic response, huh?
Yeah.
Great.
But well, it's crop circles, it's... The aliens and crop circles, well, that's a dubious connection at best.
That's true. When we were investigating crop circles and we spoke to a number of local experts in England who had spent a lot of time investigating crop circles, they told us that 99% of the crop circles were made by humans, maybe channeling some ET influences, but humans, you know, getting up at night.
Inspired humans.
But there was that 1% that was inexplicable, and that was attributed to the A-team.
Right.
Yeah.
The A-team.
The A-team. Undisclosed.
Right. So, $100 million understanding in the search for intelligent life. Interesting story.
Good use of funds. I'd like a job like that.
Wouldn't you?
Sure. Although nobody had to pay me to search for aliens. I managed to find them right here at home.
Yes.
That's right. Oh, well, there's several in the room. KSEO is full of them. Teaming with them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes, this is alien headquarters here.
That's right.
Talking about the Jeff Bezos stories earlier about his project.
Blue Origin. Hey,
Blue Origin. It's kind of interesting because we have another piece in our lineup of 7 famous quotes about the future that are actually fake.
Oh, yeah. Those are
thank
fun.
You, appreciate it.
Yay.
Yeah.
We've got our crack team here helping us get our devices online so that we're not flying blind.
Well, one of the fake quotes was, remote shopping, while entirely feasible, will flop. Remote shopping will entirely will flop. And that was Time Magazine in 1966.
Oh, 1966. They thought, well, what kind of remote shopping could you do in 66? Like call your TV phone number or something?
No, they kind of thought you might be able to do it.
It was pie in the sky. I mean, it didn't exist. It wasn't an internet, obviously.
No, it was video phones back then. So remember, there's the New York World's Fair, 1965, 66.
Yeah.
The quote from Time Magazine was, as for shopping, the housewife should be able to switch on to the local supermarket on the video phone, examine grapefruits, and price them, all without stirring from her living room. But among the futurists, fortunately, are skeptics, and they are sure that remote shopping, while entirely feasible, will flop, because women like to get out of the house, like to handle the merchandise, like to be able to change their minds. And
good
not just
point.
Buy something online.
Yes, we want to squeeze our grapefruits even today. And yet, we're still imagining automated shopping experiences.
Yes. So they
maybe not for grapefruits.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, they did suggest the idea. It was a very techno-positive article back in 66. But they did say that, you know, shopping for fruit, maybe not such a great idea.
Hmm.
And it's true. I don't buy my fruit over Amazon. Do you?
No.
No.
No. Nope, fruit is very personal.
Very.
How about you, folks? Do you shop in an automated fashion, and would you buy fruit that way? If you have anything you want to say, give us a call here at 831-479-1080. Think about the future, what it looks like.
Another interesting thing, you know, we were in Canada, all right, and one of the stories while we were gone was this little pink pill that came out, the female libido pill.
The little pink female libido pill came out when we were in Canada?
Yes, it was, maybe you weren't hearing about it because we were off the grid a little bit, but it was a newly approved pink pill. It was called the female Viagra, and its job is more difficult and subtle one than for the male pill, is that it doesn't change sexual performance, but desire.
Well, desire does change sexual performance. Come on, everybody knows that, don't they?
Well, it's a little more complex, you know, playing with desire. I don't know. What struck me as interesting about that was that it wasn't originally designed for increasing a woman's libido. But it was originally designed in Montreal, interestingly enough, at a school that my stepfather used to teach at, Concordia, to tan. It was a tanning drug.
Oh, well, everyone knows that a good tan will definitely make you feel more desired.
Very important in Canada, where you have less sun, you see, and, you know, you want to have a nice tan, and you can't always go to Cuba.
I see. So they were trying to get a good tanning pill. Just take a pill, get a tan.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so originally it was called flibanserin, and it was tested also for depression as one of its other organisms because it increases the brain's supply of serotonin. And when it was being tested for tanning, it was called melanotan. With the aim of preventing skin cancer. So you want too much sun, you get skin cancer. So this would help eliminate that. It's interesting. They found that with female rats, it dramatically increased the frequency of solicitation.
I see.
And that's a scientific term referring to the initiation of sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I see.
No money exchanged among the rats.
But did it give them better tans?
The rats? Yeah, right. Well, the female rats solicited males about 40 times in 30 minutes with this drug.
Right.
Even when their normal libidos were suppressed by depleting their female hormones.
Well, so, you know, this has been going on pretty much since the 60s. Yeah. Women are in a whole new league now with their powers of attraction. They're much more in charge than ever before. And of course, they were always in charge, but there's a new level of
women with high sex drive or women with low sex drive are in charge more.
I think women are in charge of themselves more.
And themselves.
They can define their sex drive according to how they, what they want. What they're looking for.
In this case, it turned out that just 9 to 14% of women with low sex drive showed an increased sexual desire with this. So it's still not for everyone. And why did it work so much better for rats than humans, you might ask?
Do you know?
The scientists speculate that the differences have to do with cultural inhibitions that humans have. It says when female rats want sex, they just go and get it. And if male one doesn't give it to them, then they go to male two. And we just don't do that in our culture.
We don't?
Typically. Maybe those that do will find this works better. I don't know.
I think there's a lot going on beyond what people are aware of.
Yeah,
some scenarios work just like that.
You can't really reduce everything to rat psychology, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, it's all looking for love. So I think people find what works. Little pink pills, I don't know if that, I don't think it's really chemical as much as it is emotional.
You think?
I think the emotions make the chemicals. And I think that women are very good at making the emotions. And then the chemicals follow.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah, that was a very unusual story for you.
You think?
Absolutely. Yeah, sort of, absolutely. Yeah. A little pink pill got your attention.
Okay. Can we go back to science fiction for a minute?
Okay.
Okay. Well, this is kind of a mixed bag here. Remember we've been talking about this new software from Google that analyzes visuals and interprets
it. Yeah, what's it called? Dream something?
Deep Dream.
Deep Dream.
It's built by Google and later released publicly. It analyzes video and tells you what's in it. Well, somebody took that software and ran the intro to Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh, the trailer?
The trailer for that software.
Right.
And asked the software to identify what was in the video.
Okay.
You know,
so what did Deep Dream find in the Star Trek trailer?
It said the planet's molten surface that you saw was chocolate sauce. That the rings around Saturn was a hair slide. That the deep blackness.
Wait, what? The rings?
Hair slide. That's
what
they said.
What's a hair slide?
I have no idea. I don't know what a hair slide is. Something females wear. Hair slides? You know, sound familiar?
A headband?
I don't know.
Okay, a headband.
Does anyone know what a hair slide is?
I would call it a headband.
Hair
being
slide.
Female.
Well, that's what the software
thought.
I mean,
the rings of Saturn, if they look like something.
Chocolate sauce.
Sounds like a pretty yummy planet.
Yeah.
A planet that looks like chocolate sauce.
Doesn't it?
Okay.
The deep blackness of space was called velvet.
Okay.
Velvet. And not bad. You know, a little poetic license to that. But the Starship Enterprise itself, that was thoroughly flustering to the algorithm. Its best guesses rapidly flicked through several possibilities. A digital clock, a stove, a CD player, an odometer, a computer mouse, an aircraft carrier. That's probably the closest. A car mirror, a jellyfish, and what was particularly funny, it thought the Enterprise was a waffle iron.
I could see that.
You think? Yeah.
Well, I guess that's a great new product idea, is like a waffle iron that looks like the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah.
Anyway, so computers still are not that smart. Even the smartest computers, even the coolest thing on the edge of Google's research frontier that is looking for recognition, letting a computer try to recognize video.
Yeah.
And
I mean, what's in the video?
The best it can do is see a waffle iron in a picture of the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah, so what's going on? The scientists think that, okay, well, image classification is a matter of experience. Humans gather information, they name things, they look around and they have experience with each other to name something. Artificial neural networks feed on big data. They're trained in huge sets of images, and the software is better than human at images that they are trained on. But anything,
so you're saying that Deep Dreams just hasn't seen enough Star Trek episodes?
They haven't seen enough stuff, yeah, in context. Contextual referencing is what they need next. Mm-hmm. And anything outside of the images that they've been taught.
They've seen lots of chocolate sauce, though.
I guess so. Yes, the Deep Dream consistently drew a barbell with a hand and an arm attached. And the reason that was because it had never seen a barbell that wasn't being held, you know, whenever it saw barbells, it had an arm, you know, and so they always are associating with what they've actually been exposed to. So that's the,
not surprising.
That's the problem with that.
These are machines that are trying to learn, right?
Yeah, well, they also say that the machines are not really experiencing the world, or they don't have anyone to ask, or even an awareness to know what they should ask. It's that primitive. They're just not aware yet. As a result,
and really, the question is, will they ever be? Like,
yeah,
what
well,
is awareness?
That's
right?
A big issue. And
awareness is not just like being able to cycle through a database of digital records and say, "Oh, this looks like that." And that's not really awareness. That's some kind of
associative
word search. That's a Google search. That's just saying these letters bring up this list.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it knows. Doesn't know.
There's
what
no
a waffle,
meaning in there.
No, it doesn't know what a waffle iron actually is. Even it just knows what they look like. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Yeah. So it's fascinating to wonder about, though, is how is our intelligence? How do we transcend this kind of list-making practice and this fixation with the micro details and actually turn that into some kind of knowledge, eventually wisdom? You know, where is meaning in all of this data? Have we actually arrived at a new place that's better?
Yes, they're working on that. I said contextual referencing systems, or they're trying to work with that. Robert Scoble was demonstrating on live Facebook streaming yesterday, a tour of a Stanford Research Institute where they have their version of video search engine looking for context and information that looked like it was pretty good also. Mm-hmm. So both Google and SRI, and the SRI had designed Siri, so they're very interested in tying in the evolution of artificial intelligence with image recognition. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that if you shoot tons and tons of video, this is all going to become more and more analyzed by the machines and allow you to sort it more effectively too. Mm-hmm. One of the other pieces that we have in our links page is about a new type of camera that edits footage from what you've shot. We're starting to see that the algorithms for telling a story are beginning to be understood.
Oh, yeah, real quick, what is that software? Because we're just about out of time, but yeah, one of the really interesting things you discovered this week was AI software that can actually look through your video and then put together a little story for you that sort of takes the best of your video.
Anyway. Yeah, it was called an algorithmic video editor. It's Shred, a company called Shred, S-H-R-E-D.
Folks, you're listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSCO Santa Cruz. And